from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. With 12 campaigns and nearly 50 years in politics under his belt, including 4 terms as governor, Jerry Brown has a lot to say about politics and the current state of the nation. KQED, in conjunction with UC Berkeley's Bancroft Library, sat down with Brown for a series of in-depth conversations that have now been made into a new series, The Political Mind of Jerry Brown. We'll hear from the team that put it together, and that's coming up after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. When he was first elected in 1974, Jerry Brown was the youngest governor in the history of California. When he finished his fourth and final term last year at the age of 80, he was its oldest. Brown's lengthy political career, which includes, by the way, stints as attorney general and mayor of Oakland, as well as 3 presidential runs, looms large over California's political landscape. KQED reporters Scott Schaefer and Guy Maserati, along with historians from Berkeley's Bancroft Library, recently sat down with Governor Brown for a wide-ranging conversation about his legacy, a word that he doesn't necessarily, shall we say, embrace. Those interviews are now part of a new series, The Political Mind of Jerry Brown, which begins airing on January 8th. KQED Scott Schaefer, Guy Maserati, and the Bancroft Library's Martin Meeker join us this hour to share how the interviews highlight Jerry Brown's lasting impact on California politics and his perspective on California's future. Let me first welcome my colleague, Scott Schaefer, senior editor of KQED's Politics and Government Desk, co-host of the Political Breakdown podcast, and so he will be appearing, actually, with Jerry Brown January 13th at the Herbst Theater from 7 to 8, 401 Van Ness Avenue. And welcome, Scott.
Hi, Michael.
Hi to you, and hi to Guy Maserati, reporter for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Welcome.
Good morning.
And good morning to Martin Meeker, again, who is director of the Oral History Center at the Bancroft Library. Welcome.
Good morning, Michael.
And congratulations to the three of you for this yeoman work that I think is important and will make a difference. And Scott, to begin with you, this was something I think maybe Governor Brown was feeling a little bit prickly about, that he wasn't getting the people coming asking for political advice or, you know, and you guys took up the reins.
Yeah, that was one of the very first things he told us, is how surprised he is that given his experience, he's been in public life for over 50 years now, that more people don't call him and ask for his advice, you know. So, and I think he feels that at the very end, you'll hear of our series, he says, you know, I hope people will consult this, both the podcast and the oral transcripts, which is a verbatim transcript of our conversations of, 40 hours. You know, people will take advantage of his vast knowledge and experience and lessons that he's learned in a lifetime of politics.
And not the easiest man to interview, I think we could say, or politician interview, but we can get into that in the course of this hour. I spent many times going at it with him on many different ways. And talk about, though, how this project got underway. Working with Bancroft, and what was the genesis?
Sure. Well, you know, it was in the closing months of his administration. So we're talking about, October, maybe September of 2018. He's about to leave office. And I just thought, you know, somebody ought to do an oral history with this guy. He's had such an extraordinary life and had such an incredible impact on California public policy and politics and the image of California. And the first thing I thought of was the Bancroft Library and the Oral History Center, because that's what they do. And so I remember, it was a Friday afternoon, I sent Martin, I didn't know Martin, I sent him an email, and literally within an hour and a half, he responded and said, you know, we were thinking about the same thing, let's do it. And we went to the governor and, you know, he said yes. I'm not sure he knew exactly what he was saying yes to, because we met with him a few days before he left office, and he said, now what are we doing? He really embraced it, and we all sat down for many hours at his ranch up in Colusa County.
Well, you hear a lot of time was spent up in Colusa with Jerry and Ann and their 2 dogs, but there's also a kind of inimitable style that comes through right away in the first interview. This is what I would call Jerry Brown's unique interview style in response to interviews, which often is asking questions of other questions. Here's a cut from the first episode.
I was a little surprised to hear that others weren't tapping into this fountain of political knowledge. Well, then the interview started.
Well, let's talk about the beginning of you, which is, I think, April 7th, 1938.
Yeah, I have no recollection of that.
Well, others do.
Brown questions your questions.
See, you can't even formulate that question in a way that I can make use of it. But I get
and often critiques what you're asking before answering it.
Well, first of all, I don't think that question is entirely clear.
And don't even bother asking him what people are like.
What are people like? You know, if you ask me, what are you like? I'd be hard-pressed to give you an answer.
That may be why more people don't call him for advice.
Well, see, the old joke about psychiatrists, they always answer a question with another question, and it's certainly true to some degree about Jerry Brown. But there are constraints when you're interviewing him because his eccentricities really enter the picture.
Yeah, you know, we expected that to a certain extent, but when you're in the middle of it and he's critiquing your questions, you know, it does take you back, and it takes a while to adjust to that. You know, you don't ask him anymore, what are people like? You don't ask him, what were you feeling when? You know, you stop asking those questions because you know he's not going to answer them. And I think, and Guy and Martin should speak to this as well, but, you know, when we first sat down with him, we did this chronologically more or less. And so we started off talking about his childhood, and he was very resistant to talking about that. We circled back to it later on, and he was, you know, by that time more warmed up in meeting with us and talking with us. But, you know, clearly it was when we got into the politics of his life that he really perked up and really wanted to talk.
Yeah, that's guy you want to join in
that's
here.
That's when he was really invigorated. I think we felt – I mean, even the tape that you hear of him going back and forth with Martin and with Scott and with Todd Holmes, also from the Bancroft Library, who was with us through all the interviews. That's great material. That's great tape. And I think that's where you really get to the Jerry Brown style. I think what concerned us in the earlier interviews was he really didn't seem that interested in reflecting on personal relationships he had with family members, especially with his father, who was the former governor. It was really as we got into his own political career and he kind of put on his analyst hat that the tape started getting really good.
Well, you started off talking, I think, about medflies, didn't you? Early on, in terms of that first gubernatorial administration?
Right. We ended up bringing the Medfly controversy. This was in 1981 when Brown was in his second term as governor. We brought that early on in the show because I think that's when Scott first arrived in California, had his first interactions with Brown as governor.
As a citizen.
As a citizen, yeah.
I was 21.
But I think that – and, you know, we come back to that later in the show because that's something that – you know, Jerry Brown is not very apologetic about really much that he's done in his career. And I think Medfly was one of the few cases where he really reflected on it and felt like, if I had a chance to do this again, there's things I would have done differently, responses that I would have taken, maybe to spray more and spray earlier. As it was, he was really caught on the defensive by the Reagan administration and only forced to spray after California was threatened with a quarantine.
Jump ahead for just a moment, because what about Prop 13? I mean, he's certainly been criticized for maybe the possibility of having staved it off and not doing it.
I think this is another point where he, I think, would want to do something over. In fact, he said if he had the ability to do things over, he would have proactively put a ballot measure on the ballot to counteract Prop 13 months beforehand, probably in 1977. As it played out, the Democrats in the legislature ultimately put a ballot measure on to compete with Prop 13, but it was way late in the process. It was only made it to the ballot a few months before the June primary. At that point, it was kind of a lost cause. And I think jumping ahead to Brown's second two terms, he learned the power of the ballot and the power that the governor has using campaign money to go directly to the voters when you can't get something done in the legislature. He didn't do that his first two terms as governor. He was really often caught on the defensive. Fast forward to these last two terms, criminal justice, you know, saving the state budget with Prop 30, putting water bonds, rainy day funds. He went to the ballot again and again. And I think that's where he felt like he could use the pulpit that he had to make change without needing to, you know, get involved with the legislature.
And more taxes. And in Oakland, he used the ballot as well, of course. I mean, in some ways, it kind of highlighted his career. Let me go to another cut here, because I think what we're hearing now is Brown's theory about running as an outsider, which is he talks about shiny new objects and the like. Let's hear.
When you're an out
of elected office,
your game plan is to get the ins out and to get the outs in. That, however you want to state it, thus it ever is. If you look at my father's got a campaign poster that I have running for DA, I think it was 1939. It says, new and competent. It's new, shiny new object. That's very important, whether it's president or dog catcher.
Well, he did manage to change a lot of things, even in those, well, not only as governor both times, but certainly governor the first two administrations. And I'm wondering, I want to bring Martin into this discussion, but I'm wondering to hear from any one of you, what actually turned him toward the presidency? I mean, it seemed like in some respects he was getting bored maybe, or he thought, you know, I want to try something new here. And that was sort of the behind it. Well, Martin, you want to take that?
Well, one thing you definitely get in these interviews is that for Jerry Brown, politics is the family business. In fact, I think he even says that at some point in time. And he's also not shy about reflecting on his own career and saying that at various points he was always looking forward to what the next office was be. And in the United States, that terminal office is always going to be the president of the United States. So I think that as soon as he starts having early success in Los Angeles and then as Secretary of State and is elected the youngest governor in the state's history, all of a sudden, of course, he sees, you know, the ring that he wants to catch is the presidency. And with Watergate happening, I think that he really saw that 1976 could have been his opportunity.
Well, here's Leader Pelosi talking about his presidential run. And as many of you may recall, he actually won a primary in Maryland. And that's, of course, Nancy Pelosi's home state. Let's hear.
He was young. He was fresh. He was new and free of other, shall we say, past perceptions of how things should be.
Pelosi recalls a rally at the University of Maryland where students were eating up Brown's message.
The gym was packed and jammed. People were hanging from the rafters practically, you know, overcrowded, people outside, the rest of it. And Jerry Brown got out there and he made this great speech on the environment. Oh, they were cheering and roaring and cheering. And then he said, now when you leave here, I want you to go home and place a brick in the water tank of your toilet.
Limit the amount of water that a toilet can consume.
So that you don't waste so much water.
From 7 gallons per flush to 3.5 gallons.
And the crowd went crazy. They roared and roared and roared. And my brother said, I think I'm a dinosaur in politics when somebody gets this raging standing ovation for putting a brick in the toilet. But anyway, he was new and fresh and really very well received, and he won.
And what a funny line from Pelosi's brother. But that, let me go back to you, Martin Meeker. That really began the identification in a strong way with environmental policies and environmental activism and really becoming an activist in a warrior sense.
I think so. And I also think that that word limit, the idea of putting a brick in your toilet so you don't use as much water, that is something that runs, I think, throughout his entire life. I think that you get different Jerry Browns. You get the Jerry Brown as mayor. You get sort of the prophet wandering in the wilderness in the 1980s and 1990s. You have this sort of forward-thinking, creative, explode-all-the-boxes thinker in the 1970s. But throughout all of it, there's always this belief in the virtue of austerity. And that certainly goes back to his time in the seminary. And so I think that that's kind
of deciding to drive a Plymouth, actually.
Right. Deciding to drive a Plymouth, to not live in either of the governor's mansions during those first two terms. This is something I think that is a very interesting through line, which is probably a phrase that he wouldn't like very much, but it's something that I think is quite clear when you look at the full transcript.
Well, and one of the things, Michael, you know, the Blue Plymouth is sort of a famous icon of his first time as governor. You know, he famously gave up the big limousine that Ronald Reagan was using when he was governor. He moved into a much more modest apartment across from the Capitol. And, you know, obviously, I think at one point I said, you know, were you you were thinking, you know, to what extent was this sort of like politics versus what you really wanted to do because of your values? And he was very clear that, like, everything is about performance. Everything is about politics. And he said at one point—
He said, like, about talk show hosts, too.
Yeah. And he said, you know, I think he quoted Ronald Reagan. That was another thing, how much he admired in some ways Ronald Reagan, even though he defeated his father. He learned a lot from Ronald Reagan. And he said he quoted Reagan saying, you know, I don't know how anybody who hasn't had acting experience could run for president. No, so he was very mindful of those things.
And that's really when you get to the second episode is all
Scott
about
Maserati.
His political rise. And that's really the idea of becoming an outsider, which from the outside you think, how is this possible? He's the son of a governor. He grew up around politics. He was meeting presidential candidates and foreign leaders throughout his childhood. How could it be possible that he starts his own political career as an outsider? But he learned a lot from Ronald Reagan. I think he saw in 1966 that his own path, if he was going to get to the governor's office, couldn't be just by following his father. He had to create this outsider image, and really the way that he did it was through campaign finance reform.
He also talked about limits of what I can do early on, and Brown officially launched actually a second run for president in November 79. He was talking about these run for presidents. I do want to get to Oakland too, because to some extent that's where he felt maybe more focused and more interested, you know, being a mayor. He even wanted to run at one point for mayor of Los Angeles, or considered it. Sort of the George Gascon trajectory, but he was thinking he could capture the zeitgeist with a platform that was, I guess, described as outside the box. Let's hear.
Jerry Brown officially launched his second run for president in November of 1979, thinking he could capture the zeitgeist with a platform that was, shall we say, a little bit outside the box.
Protect the earth, explore the universe, and serve the people.
How did you come up with that slogan?
How did I come up with it? I had a cup of coffee. And what does that mean? How did I come up with it?
Was it your idea?
How'd you come up with that? That question, how'd you come up with that question? It's part of the flow here. How can I state what I think is important?
The balanced budget was one plank of Brown's agenda, which put him to the right of President Carter. The other plank was speaking out against nuclear power and for solar energy, protecting the earth. And there, Brown was to the left of the president.
President Carter's solar energy is a good start, but I believe we need a more rapid and greater investment in renewable resources such as solar energy.
And then there was exploring the universe, space exploration, researching the atmosphere, which just underscored his nickname, Governor Moonbeam.
What I saw is the connection is fiscal imbalance with environmental imbalance.
In other words, Brown saw a connection between living more simply and taking care of the environment. But on the national scene, that's not what most voters and political observers saw.
Is he a conservative? Is he a liberal? Or is he just a political opportunist who senses when political tides are changing and how to ride them?
It so happened that the zeitgeist, or maybe I'll call it the ethos, made it very difficult to connect those two ideas. Because the small mind does say, ooh, you don't want to overspend. You're a Republican. Oh, you don't like nuclear power. Well, you're a liberal. You're a Democrat or something. So you put the two together, and that creates a certain cognitive dissonance that I was not able to overcome in the 1980 election.
Well, let me go back to Mark Meeker on this, because the one sort of indigenous philosophy that is American is pragmatism. And ultimately, I see Jerry Brown in the overall picture as a pragmatist, but he was influenced by so many other things. He was influenced by Cesar Chavez. He was influenced by Zen, all these environmental ideas and going into space, as the podcast reveals to us. But let's talk about two figures particularly early on, Bateson and Shoemaker.
Right. So Shoemaker, of course, is the small is beautiful idea. And I think that some of that conversation that you just played came from a conversation that we were having in the midst of the interview, in which I was pointing out to him what I considered to be potential contradictions in his philosophy. And that is, you know, Shoemaker, small is beautiful. Let's back off from technology and perhaps return to Eden. Right. Another end was Whole Earth Catalog, Stuart Brand, let's go to the stars. And to me, I thought, okay, this, you know, these are not exactly within line with each other. But, you know, as he said, that's small mind thinking, I think. And I think he resolves it in an interesting way. I don't know. I'm curious, Scott, how do you think he would resolve that contradiction?
Well, I think, you know, in
he
some
would
way,
say like Whitman, do I contradict myself? Well, then I contradict myself.
I think he actually did say that in the interview, frankly. Yeah.
You know, I think in some ways he doesn't try to resolve it. You know, I think he's comfortable with contradictions. You know, you don't have to be consistent all the time in your philosophy. You can be for less spending, you know, which is a conservative idea, and, you know, being against nuclear power. And certainly now with what's happening with Iran, I'm sure he's thinking about that more than ever, and nuclear weapons and accidents and so on. So I think, yeah, he's critical, I think, of people who need to kind of square that contradiction, and he doesn't really care as much. That said, I do think he paid a price for it politically, because voters really couldn't.
And I think he saw that the political world is a different world, and that, you know, it's much easier to run as in a horse race when you have a lane. And I think, as he talked about in 1980, he felt like he set himself up in a way where he didn't really have a lane in that race. He was to the left of Carter on some issues. He was to the right of Carter on other issues. And he kind of left himself vulnerable when Ted Kennedy entered the race. He was kind of a man without really a position.
Jerry was really, in many ways, I mean, aside from having all that Jesuit training, he was really an intellectual, and he was in love with the world of ideas and really engaged with them in a major way. I think that was certainly one of his strong points. But I want to get back to Oakland because it plays such a central role in his development of a political mind, as we're talking about here, and really what you were able to glean from all of these interview hours that you put in with him. In Oakland, well, actually, let's hear a cut, first of all. This is Jerry Brown sharing his thoughts on gentrification and talking about an encounter he had with one of his constituents during his time as mayor of Oakland.
He remembers one African-American woman he met getting off a plane.
She said to me, "Mayor, why are you driving the blacks out of Oakland?" I said, "I'm not doing that." She said, "Well, you're raising all the rents." And she, I think, felt I was raising the rents. But the rents were rising because Oakland was becoming more attractive as a place, and there was all this surplus money flowing out of the growing prosperity. But that was felt as a change.
Well, and another word for what that woman on the plane was describing was gentrification, right? I mean,
right, but that's an interesting word. There's a certain ideology there. If your medicine has to be government medicine, if your housing has to be government housing, if your schools have to be government schools, that's a very different America than we've had up till now. But there are people who, whether they realize it or not, that's what they're advocating.
Yeah, Guy Maserati, there again is that inconsistency. I mean, he was all for austerity and all for a kind of what would often be translated by many people's minds of sharing so that the inequalities of wealth would be ameliorated, and yet many people saw him as gentrifying. And
right, and I think, you know, in the episode on Oakland, I think we'll possibly the most controversial of the series because he remains really unapologetic and defending all the initiatives he took forward, whether education, on crime, and on development. I think he feels like, you know, Oakland really gave him a look after spending so much time in Sacramento, kind of having a bird's eye view of government. Usually it works in the inverse. You start out in local government and you work your way up. This was really his first opportunity to get hands-on, and he spent a lot of time riding around with cops on their beat, going to construction sites, knocking on doors of neighbors, asking them to allow more development around where they live. And I think critics will say that getting closer didn't necessarily remove the blind spots that he had. Policing would be a big one. And I think to this day he feels like it's not really there's a limit on what the government can do to ameliorate the downsides of development.
Which I think you bring in the voice of Nancy Nadell there, who says, you know, there was excessive force and brutality on the part of police and it wasn't taken into consideration enough by Brown when he was mayor. We're going to hear from our listeners, though. What stands out to you from Jerry Brown's five-decade political career? You can give us a call right now. We invite you to do that. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Please feel free to be part of the program. The number again, 866-733-6786, or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org or post them at kqed.org/forum. Talking with Scott Schaefer, Guy Maserati, and Martin Meeker, and you, our listeners, when we return. And this is all about the new KQED series going inside the political mind of Jerry Brown. And not only the political mind, but the mind itself. Stay tuned for more. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about KQED's new series, The Political Mind of Jerry Brown, which begins airing on January 8th with Scott Schaefer, senior editor of KQED's Politics and Government Desk and co-host of Political Breakdown Show, and Guy Maserati, reporter for KQED's Politics and Government Desk, and Martin Meeker, who is director of the Oral History Center at the Bancroft Library. The entire 800-page transcript will be online on Wednesday. You can go to uclib.link/OHC-J Brown. And you can also join us if you have any thoughts or reflections or questions to ask about the extraordinary 50-year career of Jerry Brown. We do want to hear from you. In fact, you can give us a call right now at 866-733-6786. Number again, 866-733-6786, or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them at kqed.org/forum. And I ought to add here that there is certainly a lot about Jerry Brown's gubernatorial administrations, as well as his run for the presidency and his being mayor of Oakland. And particularly the focus is on trying to deal with problems in Oakland having to do with housing and gentrification, but also with crime and with the police and with the schools, which Jerry Brown also really made his mark in. I mean, talk about that guy.
Right. I mean, he ultimately, I think when he got to Oakland, his initial, and this came about in a lot of different initiatives he took on in Oakland, his first instinct was, let me just try to get more control. So he put forward a ballot measure in 2000 that allowed him to appoint additional members to the Oakland School Board. No other mayor in the state had that power. But that still didn't give him a majority, and so it really didn't elicit any kind of change that he was looking for. So he went a step further and said, okay, well, how about I just start my own school? So he ultimately started the Oakland Military Institute, the art school, and now he's back on the board of the Military Institute. So I think he felt like there was not a real direct way for the mayor to make change in the school district, so he kind of went his own way. And that got him a lot of criticism because these charter schools were bringing in a lot more money than, you know, your regular Oakland public school was able to get.
Well, and I think one of the reasons he's back on the board of that school is he realizes it's not doing as well as it could or as that he'd hoped it would. And that's one of the things you hear in the podcast and the chapter, so to speak, the episode about Oakland is, you know, he realized both with the ballot measure that did not bring about the change he was hoping for, but also just the difficulty of getting schools to perform and getting kids to do well, especially kids from, you know, challenging backgrounds, low-income families where there's a lot of you know, violence or whatever it might be that they're dealing with, racism and so on. And so I think he's realized that it was easier said than done. But it's still an issue he thinks about a lot. In fact, Michael, he told us that after he left the governor's office just recently last year, he was thinking about running for state school superintendent. That's how much he cares about public education. He, of course, decided not to, but he did think about it.
As opposed to running for mayor of L.A., which
he thought about doing before he ran for mayor of Oakland. We joked with him about, you know, have you thought about being mayor of Williams, you know, which is the little town he lives in now or nearby. And I think he probably thought about that as well.
Well, there are a lot of, like, paths not taken. I think you realize talking to him that it's just he's constantly thinking about what's the next office or what's another avenue I can take. When he first got into politics, he thought about running for Congress around Long Beach.
He also considered running for the Senate, I mean the U.S. Senate. You know, he was kind of a polymath and he was interested in so many things and curious about so many things. One of the things that made him unique, and I was just thinking about, you know, how I suppose one of the big accomplishments that one immediately has to accede to giving a great deal of gratification for is balancing the real revenue problems we had in this state, I mean, which he had enormous effect on the deficit and getting our credit rating restored and so forth. But let's go back to the early years for just a moment, Scott, before we start bringing our callers into that. I mean, got the first farm workers agreement that was ever, for that matter, brought to fruition in the United States of America.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things he told us is that when he got into the governor's office, he thought about what can I do as governor that no one else can do? You know, what would not happen but for me being governor? And this was one of the things that he really focused on, was getting more labor rights for farm workers, giving them the right to organize. And he put a lot of time into it. He told us that he didn't think any governor had spent as much time as he did passing legislation, which did pass and which he did sign. The legislature, Democrats in the legislature, had tried several times when Reagan was governor to get a similar bill passed, and it failed, partly because there was, you know, great opposition from the growers, you know, among others. But he did get it done, and that was clearly one of his signature accomplishments when he was governor the first time. Although I think when he got that done, he sort of felt like, well, what else is there? I've done that, and I've done maybe a couple of other things. So that's when he decided to run for president in 1976.
And certainly, I think it's safe to say, wouldn't you say, Martin, that Cesar Chavez had an enormous influence on his thinking, just like Cesar Chavez did on Bobby Kennedy's thinking. There was great impact there, but also. It's funny when you think about the people he names as being intellectual influences on him. One is Robert Oppenheimer, you know. He says because of his pessimism. Here's Jerry Brown, you know, working on behalf of saving the planet and being perhaps more optimistic than just about anybody that it can be done.
The Chavez relationship is interesting, and it's pretty well documented in this interview. Not only is there the Jerry Brown Cesar Chavez relationship, but it certainly goes back, of course, to his father, who infamously stayed home over Easter, I think, in Palm Springs, instead of going meeting the marchers up in Sacramento, which was seen as a big stain against the governor and perhaps contributed to his defeat in terms of not being able to raise his base in 1966. So, you know, Jerry Brown, of course, really wanted to mend that and do progressive work in that area where his father didn't succeed.
I think he was also sort of struck by the sort of the pageantry and the romance almost of Cesar Chavez and of his movement. And I think it had maybe echoes of his time in the seminary, you know, the religious, spiritual aspect to what they were doing. I think that really resonated with him.
And there are a lot of echoes from the seminary. I was thinking about what you capture in the podcast, getting him to talk about Carol Chisman and capital punishment, you know, and he appointed Rose Byrd because to some extent, which later had consequences, that had to do with her position on capital punishment. A lot of those things, I think, came right out of his Jesuit training.
Right. And I mean, that's the first episode is really about largely his time in the seminary and this first encounter he has with the real world of politics, which is the Carl Chessman impending execution. His father's in the governor's office considering whether to put a moratorium. And he gets a call from Jerry fresh out of the seminary saying, look, you can't do this. You can't execute this guy. He hasn't killed anyone. And I think Brown he's held that opposition to capital punishment throughout the rest of his career. But at the time, he didn't know really the political calculus of it. It turned out to be a disaster for Pat Brown politically. And as you know, Jerry Brown reflecting on it says, you know, how I was like a Patagonian fresh out just offering advice into the California Capitol. He didn't really know that world, and there were some ramifications for that.
And little did he know that it would take Gavin Newsom to get rid of capital punishment. Actually, a number of questions about the relationship to Newsom. Let me just read one of these. Mike says, I cherish Jerry Brown because in the age of California's one-party government, he was the goalie who kept the worst legislation from hitting the net. To mix my metaphor, current Governor Gavin Newsom is far more of a rubber stamp. We're going a little far afield here, but I'm just interested in your thoughts about this because there was an article in today's LA Times about Newsom being too scattered and that kind of criticism. I'm sure you've heard it, Scott.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We had a lot of conversations with Jerry Brown, obviously, on the record, but we also had a lot of conversations like while we were eating lunch or while we were setting up. And he had a lot of things to say about other politicians in California, shall we say. He is critical, I think, of perhaps the lack of focus sometimes that he sees coming out of the governor's office now. But you know what? That is very much what we saw in 1975 right. And 76
tell the story
and
about,
77.
Tell the story about the turtle food. You know the story I'm talking about? There was some focus that Brown immediately paid his attention to with respect to turtles. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
I don't. That didn't come up in our conversations. But he ran that office the first time around, sort of like a graduate school seminar, you know, and he would have these late night meetings. And I mean, 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night where people would come in and he'd bring in interesting speakers who would, you know, opine about philosophical questions that had nothing to do with really what was going on in Sacramento, but which he found interesting. And I think that was one of the ways in which his administration the first time, you know, kind of went off the rails a few times and got distracted by other things. And his sister, Kathleen, when we were talking to her, said, you know, if Jerry had married Anne Gus Brown, his wife now, if he had married her earlier, he would have been president because she brought focus and discipline to
him. And there is a certain rhythm to these relationships within the Capitol that there's any new governor comes in, he brings with him a new staff. They have to make relationships with leaders in the legislature. And it was the same thing with Brown when he arrived in 1975. I mean, these legislators were much older than him. He brought in a new team of people who had never really worked in state government before. He was not just bringing in his dad's old hands. And I think you see this again and again with new governors. I don't think there's anything, out of the ordinary with Newsom in this regard.
Well, let me bring our callers aboard here, and let's begin with you, Dan. You're on the air. Good morning.
Well, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a short little story and then a question. My memory of Mr. Brown was when he was running against Whitman. They were having some sort of town hall event with a largely women's voter group, and Jerry Brown impressed me with his ability to read a room. The question came, Whitman responded with her position to a lot of kind of boos and oohs, and I could see
Jerry Brown's eyes read the room, and he wouldn't say he did a 180 on his position, but he certainly changed in order to meet the crowd. So my question is that the Jerry Brown from the 70s, or is this the new Jerry Brown after he went away and then came back? Thank you.
You're getting a lot of smiles to your question. Who wants to jump in?
I think that is quintessential Jerry Brown. I mean, one of the episodes, each of the episodes is sort of organized around a lesson or a principle that Jerry Brown talked with us about. And one of them was the eye, having the eye or the ear, you know, to really, whether it's read a room or read the zeitgeist of the political situation. And he does that almost all the time and certainly is still doing it, I think. So it isn't something that was, you know, that came to him after he was, you know, in the wilderness for several years in Japan and India and elsewhere. You know, it's very much a part of his political – he is a political animal. You know, he's used that phrase. We thought about naming the series a political animal because that is what he is. And, you know, that calculation, that ability to read the room. Now, we should also say that eluded him in many points in his career. He lost the eye. And pay the price for it.
I just want to clarify what I was talking about before. It was a story about a ban on turtles. I think, describing to kill it was Caribbean turtle meat that he did incredible amount of study on, and that was just the way his mind worked. You know, to the exclusion of, so the argument went, and so some of his detractors said, other stuff that was going on that was really important.
Yeah, well,
he would just laser.
Yeah, when we went up to visit him, the very first time we went up to Colusa, and I think I'd asked him, you know, you try to make small talk with Jerry Brown, it's a little challenging sometimes. And I just asked him, like, you know, what do you miss, you know, from the governor's office? This is just like February of 2019. And he's like, I don't miss anything. Look at the land. Look at the geology here. I'm busy learning about the rocks and the rivers and the formations in the land. And I'm trying to grow tomatoes up here. And why are the leaves turning yellow? Martin gave him a whole tutorial on growing tomatoes.
Loved learning. And yes. He loved education. Of course, as an educator myself, you know, people were angry at him back in the day because he had a kind of battle with professors, and he used to talk about they should be getting psychic dollars rather than, you know, real income and so forth. But that was, again, part of his thinking. Martin?
The psychic dollars, I mean, that's a really interesting hole to go down in terms of his relationship with education, in particular higher education in California. Also thinking about his influence of Ivan Illich and the de-schooling of society. Those are all really interesting questions. There was a really interesting –
He loved Illich. I mean, he really worshipped him in many ways, I think.
Right. And there was a really interesting moment in terms of, you know, who is Jerry Brown and maybe what kind of Democrat is he? At one point near the end of the interviews, I asked him, is being a Democrat, is that taking a set of ideological positions or adhering to certain policies, or is it tribal? And he responded immediately, it's tribal for him. Mm-hmm. And so I think when you're looking at, you know, does Jerry Brown fit within this particular policy position that's typical of a Democrat, that's not the way to look at him. It's sort of like he's a tribal Democrat, and he pursues his own way within that particular
tribal
context.
Democrat who considers himself a maverick, I think, would be maybe an apt way to describe him.
Right.
Leslie joins us next. Leslie, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Yeah, echoing the higher education and the legacy of his father, one of the best public higher education systems in the planet. But turning to the community colleges, you know, his father had turned from the junior colleges to community colleges, and Brown kind of pushed it back in trying to put it all and focused on transfer and degrees and stuff like that in a world where we no longer have lifelong employment. People need to come in to catch a class. There's isolation in our community. And taking the community out of the community college seems kind of the opposite of, I don't know, the moonbeamy, the thoughtful guy, turning it into – I just wondered if you had insight of why it kind of went back to a 1950 focus rather than moving forward and helping the community colleges take us into climate change and getting rid of plastic, for example.
That's interesting. I'm not sure I've got a good handle on what his community college policies were.
No, I mean, interestingly, though, his career began in 1969, the first office he ran for. Yeah. This is a bit of a digression, but the first office he ran for was a new one down in Los Angeles. It was the L.A. community college district, and he ran. There were 133 or 134 candidates. He came in first, and so I think he did have. That was just, I think, a testing of the waters. And how is the name Brown doing? But you know, he's clearly, and Martin, you know, coming from the university, I think you probably felt more than maybe Guy or I did the sort of animosity sometimes that he feels toward higher education and the expense and the cost and like why do you need to be in a classroom with people whether you're you know it's K through 12. I think he likes to think outside the box, like maybe why can't we do these courses online? Like, what's the benefit?
He was a big advocate of that, in fact. Yeah. Let me thank the caller and go right to another call, and that's you. Cecile, you're on the air. Good morning.
Thank you. I just want to thank the people who are doing this because I think it's really a wonderful project. I am struck with how we don't ask our elders to leave their legacy. For example, the Senator Paul Sarbanes, who was a great senator for 30 years and is never called on to speak after he leaves office. And so I'm doing a little plea for the elders. And Michael, I'd love you to have Joanna Macy on your program sometime. Let's celebrate elders. But what I called about was Jerry Brown was like a, you know, he had almost had a tragic flaw. He had a program on KPFA for a long time. He could never listen to his guests. And he really had that flaw.
You know, you're getting some laughs here because I told a little anecdote, and I'll tell it on the air. When Jerry took over that job at KPFA, he actually asked me for advice about being a talk show host, and I don't presume to be able to have any sage wisdom on this. But in his case, I said, develop your sense of humor more and try to listen more. Those are two, I thought, good pieces of advice tailored to him. I think he did develop a sense of humor. He became funnier. But as a listener, I don't know. The final verdict isn't in. But good to hear from you, and I appreciate your call. And Wynn wants to know if there's any chance Jerry Brown will run for any other political office. At 80, I don't think so. But you never know.
Don't rule it out.
Yeah, I think the wheels are still turning. I think so much of this project was retrospective. We're taking him through his career, talking about his life in politics. But I think often where he wanted the conversation to go was the present and talking about the initiatives he's still engaged in, whether that's around nuclear proliferation, education. I think he still is very much actively thinking about modern-day politics, whether or not he'll actually...
He still has about $15 million in the bank, by the way. So yeah, he'll use that to defend of his legislation.
He's always understood frugality and saving money, not only on the state side, but personally. But you know,
in one of our final conversations, actually, he off-camera, he had mentioned that he knew that there were rumors of a new candidate entering the 2020 race. And, you know, we were all guessing. But, of course, the first question was, well, is that you, Governor Brown? So it turned out it was Bloomberg or maybe Deval Patrick or both.
We did ask him, did you think about running in 2016 for president? And, of course, he did. But I don't think he said, I'm always thinking about running for something. And I think that is true today.
I don't know that he relished another run against a Clinton.
No.
Because he did in 92, and that didn't turn out so well.
Well, he's become more singularly identified with the environment probably than any candidate we've seen come along, including the governor of Washington. And mainly because of things here in California like cap and trade and reduction of greenhouse gases. But if we are going to talk about legacy, we also have to talk, I think, about no extraction tax like in Texas and Oklahoma and the fact that he was – not exactly supportive, but certainly not against fracking.
Yeah, I think that was one of the criticisms of the so-called Leave It in the Ground coalition. You know, they followed him actually to Europe for a conference on climate change, and they were protesting him because he did take some money from oil companies for Prop 30, for the Prop 30 campaign. And, you know, his point is, look, I'll take money from the oil industry to help get a tax passed on the wealthy to save the schools. You know, and I think that was another point about Jerry Brown in our conversations is just how his thinking about money and politics has evolved from that very first time he ran for statewide office as a reformer. He created essentially with a ballot measure the Fair Political Practices Commission, which is still around today. But he clearly has a very different attitude about money and politics. But yes, he was more practical about things. And, you know, you can't ban oil. You know, everyone, including environmentalists, use it every day. You know, you have to be realistic about it. Let's phase it out. Let's find alternatives. But you can't just flip a switch.
It depends. If you talk to probably Ocasio-Cortez, she might tell you there's a way to ban oil, or at least certainly to reduce it to the extent that people are not using it like they're using it now. But let me get Paul on here next. Paul, thanks for waiting. You're on. I'm sorry, Dell. Go ahead, Dell.
Oh, hey, good morning. How are you? I just thought it was funny that you guys opened up with the brick in the toilet for conservation of water when he actually sold out the Delta to send water down to deserts to development. So I wouldn't call him an environmentalist.
Well, we've got, in fact, apropos of your remarks, and I thank you for those, Del. Richard says, what did Jerry Brown have to say about his efforts to build the peripheral canal despite huge opposition by environmentalists?
Well, I think this was another issue that kind of followed him throughout his career. This was the kind of last piece of the water plan that Pat Brown never got to see finished. If you go and read Pat Brown's oral history with the Bancroft, he's still, this is taken in the late 70s, he's still talking about, God, I'm on Jerry every day asking him, when are you going to get that peripheral canal built? When are you going to finish this system? And Brown tried to do it towards the end of his second term. It was ultimately overturned by a referendum. He tried again in his third and fourth term and before Governor Newsom pulled the plug on it. So that was another thing that, like the death penalty, an issue that followed him throughout his entire political career and one that he wasn't able to end up with.
But in that sense, he did kind of, not exactly copy, but pattern himself after Edmund G. Brown, his father, with the big projects. We're not only talking about, you know, the Delta Tunnel projects, but we're also talking about, well, railway.
Mm-hmm. Right, high-speed rail. I mean, those are the two big ones left over at the end. And I think that's a marked departure from the first two terms that he served as governor, where I think he came back, and especially as the state's finances got better and better, he felt like, you know, what's a way to leave an impact? But even high-speed rail, he talked about having serious doubts. I mean, this was something that was already in place, that the voters had already approved before he took office. And he talked with us about having real issues with going forward with it, especially given the constraints that a ballot measure creates with how to develop a system. And as he told, it was really his wife who was pushing him forward, like, this is something you really should take on and get done.
Well, here's another comment from a listener. And when you talk about Jerry Brown, you always invite controversy. But this listener writes, abolishing redevelopment agencies, as bad as some of those agencies were, worsened housing and social programs, Jerry Brown accelerated gentrification.
And we should say he used redevelopment agencies when he was mayor of Oakland. I mean, right. Look at the Fox Theater. And I think it was only when he got back to state government and realized we have to cut somewhere and this looks like a ripe target. But he faced criticism the rest of his term for never bringing that money back. I mean, that was yearly money that was coming in for affordable housing. And there really wasn't a consistent stream developed until pretty much the end of his fourth term in 2017, where they're able to get a real estate transfer tax. But even that, there was never the hole that was left by ending redevelopment was never filled.
And these are certainly issues that were brought up, Mark, in the context of these interviews. We asked him about them. I'm afraid that last one was something he maybe got squirrely and got away from. We weren't able to get a full satisfactory answer. But
I should add too, like the series that we ended up doing at KQED it's eight episodes, it's 4 hours, but the conversations that we got into with the oral history go far beyond that. I mean, it's over 40 hours, and so specific policy ideas throughout his entire four terms as governor will all be on the tape.
Well, there's more criticism here. Let me read what Jeanette has to say. While I was very glad Jerry Brown was our governor with all his mostly fair and knowledgeable decisions, I felt he, as mayor of Oakland, and Willie Brown as mayor of San Francisco, made a huge blunder when fixing the East Bay Bridge after the Loma Prieta earthquake. By trying to compete with the aura of the Golden Gate Bridge, there was about a two-day delay in getting us a new and hugely needed East Bay Bridge.
Yeah, there was a lot of controversy over that and the design of the bridge. I think it was, I know Willie Brown, I'm not sure about where Jerry Brown was on this, but Willie Brown certainly wanted a more elaborate design, a more unique design that was fitting for
and
the
his
Bay
name.
Area. And, well, he got the other half. He got the old half. I think he knew that the design was potentially problematic. He didn't want his name on that part of it. Look, he's been in public life for 50 years and in some ways isn't done, Jerry Brown is. And you're going to find things that you disagree with, mistakes he made, things he could have done differently. And I know he thinks about those things as well. And we explore a lot of those in the series, which begins Wednesday night on KQED.
Yeah. And I'll remind people that Scott will be appearing with Jerry Brown on January 13th. That's a Wednesday at the Herbst Theater. It's a Monday from 7 to 8 p.m. And here's a listener who wants to know, is Jerry Brown still as anti-nuclear today as he was back in the day?
Absolutely. Yeah, no question about it. You know, when I talked with him about, I talked with him about something else more recently, and that was the first thing he talked about. He's very concerned about a mistake, you know, leading to a nuclear disaster, a war of some kind. He's actually part of the atomic clock. You know, every year they sort of set the clock minutes before midnight in terms of the danger of some kind of a nuclear confrontation. And yeah, he is very, that is, I would say, that and climate change, he's very much focused on.
And as governor, I think it ought to be said that he established himself as someone who was, shall we say, very much an adversary to President Trump. But here's what Jerry Brown had to say in this inimitable podcast that we're talking about resistance in California.
Well, I think resistance always is a word that I thought was overblown. I mean, the first time I heard resistance was the underground. You know, Camus and these people were in the resistance in France. Now we're talking about resistance from, you know, well-fed politicians. So it seems a little off to me.
And there's Camus again, Martin. This name comes up frequently, too, in Jerry Brown's discourse. But I think it's interesting that he, in some ways, removes himself from what has been identified as a resistance.
Right. This is really the focus of our last episode. And I think he felt like he never took up that banner of resistance. He was much more like, let's persist. Let's show that a democratic liberal government can work in achieving policy goals. And if you remember 2017, the months after Donald Trump was inaugurated, was probably the most prolific legislative year in decades. They were able to increase the gas tax to build roads and repair public transportation, cap and trade deal, housing deal. So I think his response was like, let's not become the state of resistance, which kind of immediately took hold in California. And even though his attorney general has filed dozens of lawsuits against the Trump administration, I think Brown was much more comfortable in the persistence mode.
Yeah, and just like real quickly, he also rejected a bill that Governor Newsom later signed to force Donald Trump to release his taxes. He said at the time when he vetoed it, I don't think it's constitutional. Gavin Newsom signed it. California Supreme Court tossed it out. So, you know, he would do things symbolically, but he also had a firm eye, I think, on what was pragmatic and what was constitutional.
Well, again, congratulations on this whole series. It's really terrific, and I hope people will avail themselves of it either online or listen to it on the air here. And we'll continue to, of course, explore the world of Jerry Brown before he leaves us. He talks about his mortality, too, in some of these interviews. He's well aware of it, as we all are, as we climb those stairs. But thank you so much for being with us. Scott Schaefer, Guy Maserati, Martin Meeker.
Thanks for having
us. Thanks, Michael.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.